Okay, if we can get going, I apologize. I had some work I had to finish. I thought we would have gotten started with somebody else chairing, but apparently I'm indispensable, I guess. So we'll start with Senate File 2616, Senator Dibble. And Senator Dibble moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, and this apparently is an unsession bill. Is that correct?
Correct, Mr. Chair. Senate File 2616 is the Department of Transportation unsession bill. It comes to finance because you'll see on the fiscal note, we bring the committee money, Mr. Chair, so we can up our targets substantially.
Okay.
See, there's a, I think, okay. $4,000 in this fiscal year, $39,000, actually $43,000 in the tails. So we need to figure out how to spend that money. So, Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment. Maybe we can take that up. We need to remove a deletion of a section, the A1 amendment.
If we could have that distributed.
Got it. Yeah, I'm looking for it.
Okay. I'm sitting here extra.
Senator Dibble, we don't have it yet.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chair, I'll have I could give it orally. It's very simple and have an explanation of it. It's on page, let's see, what is it? So it's page 14, line 30. Kind of in the middle there, there's a repeal of statute 221.251, and we would remove that from that line. In other words, we would not repeal 221.251. Mr. Chair, this statute provides a dispute resolution mechanism for consumers and freight or household goods carriers. If consumers believe they have been overcharged by a carrier, they have recourse to file a claim through MnDOT, and we need to maintain that claim process. And Mr. Rudin can explain more if you have questions about why we want to keep that statute in place. I'm not sure why it was targeted for repeal in the first place.
All right. We have Senator Dibble's motion. Is there discussion on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed.
So Mr. Chair, rather than making an inarticulate and feeble attempt to explain 2616 and then have Mr. Rudin do a better job, I'll just defer to Mr. Rudin to do a high-level overview if you so desire.
Yeah, just a little bit. Although, Senator Dibble, usually you don't do a feeble job. I can think of other adjectives, but...
Well... I probably would in this case. I would probably just read off a sheet, and I'll let Mr. Rudin read off his sheet instead.
Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudin with MnDOT Government Affairs, and perhaps I'll just address the fiscal note, which you should have before you. If you turn to page 3 of the fiscal note, at the bottom of the page you'll see that the cost savings generated by this bill come through eliminating several reporting requirements. Section 1 of the bill gives an exemption on state aid projects under $5 million from certain reporting requirements, and that would save $30,000 every other year to the department. There would also be a cost savings to local governments, which is not actually estimated, so that would be over and above that $30,000. Section 11 of the bill saves $1,000 annually by eliminating a partnerships report. Section 14 saves about $300 annually by eliminating the Special Transportation Service Provider Complaint Report. Section 15 changes the Safe Routes to Schools report from being an annual report to a report that would be provided every other year. And so that generates about $2,500 in savings. And then Section 22 eliminates the guideway report, so that saves MnDOT about $7,500 every other year. Mr. Chair, the rest of the bill really is deleting obsolete language, repealing several obsolete provisions. So I wasn't planning to go through those unless there are specific questions about anything.
You know, Senator Dibble, we have a number of bills on the agenda. There is a temptation of mine to spend about an hour or so going through this. Just out of curiosity, maps and pamphlets.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair?
Maps and pamphlets.
Pamphlets?
Pamphlets.
Oh, pamphlets.
3R16131.
I do remember having this discussion in the governor's office, and this bill was being overviewed.
I just wonder if these are the ever-popular highway maps that,
Mr. Chair,
distributed by thousands.
There's actually a separate subdivision that we're not repealing that would retain the department's responsibility to publish an official highway map.
Okay.
The subdivision we're repealing here is the pamphlets portion, and with the internet and web pages and things, it's no longer necessary to print paper pamphlets about the trunk highway system. We provide that information on the internet.
And then the next section, professional technical contracts, is that redundant with admin language?
Exactly, Mr. Chair. The department has never used this authority. We use the authority in Chapter 16C, I believe it is, that all state agencies use for professional technical contracts.
And I assume you've gone through this fairly carefully, obviously.
Mr. Chair, at one time we did, a number of weeks ago, yes. So.
Does that suggest, Senator Dibble, you've forgotten everything you went through?
Yes, Mr. Chair. But that's why we have it all written down.
And what about the park and ride section?
Mr. Chair, I believe the park and ride language we're repealing required a report that was submitted many years ago. Perhaps if you could direct me to the specific
section. Okay, I think I see what you're saying, that it simply eliminates the report to the legislature.
Correct, and that report was submitted many years ago, but for some reason the statute was never repealed.
Okay. And what about duties of the commissioner on 15R?
Mr. Chair, this section is related to what are referred to as common carriers. These carriers used to be regulated quite heavily, and since they've been deregulated, the language is no longer necessary.
Okay. And I have one other question. Mr. Nauman just pointed out on 7R, the removal of the levy limit.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, the
removal of the levy limit statute.
No more.
Mr. Chair, this is for, are you referring to 164.05, the road?
164.041.
Yes. Mr. Chair, this refers to township levies. We met with the Minnesota Association of Townships, and they were not aware of what this language was intended to do. I think when we looked when it was enacted, it was something like 20 years ago, and nobody recalls the history of why it's there. So it was felt that it was no longer necessary to be in statute.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testifier, there's probably 20 or 30 different lines here with regards to railroad legislation. Have they, they've all weighed in on that, I assume? And I ask because there's a lot of discussion about railway as not an up-and-coming form of commerce, obviously, but just a newer attention being paid to railroads. And so I guess the question still stands. The railroad folks have been informed of this, and everything is obsolete now and doesn't pertain to anything at all for future railroad legislation.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's correct. We checked with both railroad management and railroad unions on all of these repeals. Again, the railroads used to be regulated at the state level. They're now regulated at the federal level. And so all of the language you see being repealed is obsolete and no longer necessary.
And Mr. Chair, the last question that I have on those is on the last page is, can you explain to me the lieu of other taxes for non-residential aircraft, for airplane or air show exposition? Has that not been around for a while? Has it been around for a while and not been utilized? And how was it before?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's correct. It's been in law, but we have found that people who are not residents of Minnesota are not aware of this provision, and so it has not been enforced or followed in many years, and so the feeling by our Office of Aeronautics is that it's no longer necessary.
Okay, further questions from the committee? Any concluding comments, Senator Dibble?
No, Mr. Chair. I would move the bill as amended.
Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 2616 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And I think you missed my opening comment, though, that we're bringing the committee a bunch of money.
$4,000 for this.
Yes.
By the amendment, that's appreciated. And I think $43,000 for the next biennium. Okay. That'll be useful.
Good work.
Got some license plates.
Excuse me, Senator Tomasoni?
Some license plates I could do with that money.
Okay, so Senator Sharon. Senator Sharon, you've got three bills on the agenda, and I know from talking last night to your committee administrator, you'd like to, you've mentioned to me as well, as to how you'd like to handle these bills. So maybe I'll just let you start. And
okay, thank you. What we're presenting here is the licensing omnibus bill. That 1484 is the first bill that we'd like to offer. At your request, of course, what I would like to do is give you a brief understanding of what the various articles are in this bill, you should have fiscal notes for them.
So first,
before we begin on 1484, the omnibus licensing bill, and the first action that I would request is that the committee would adopt the A32 amendment.
Well, first, I think we've got a division report. So Senator Laurie moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. So, Senator Sharon, you.
The A32 amendment to Senate File 1484.
We have that to distribute.
I will explain the
Senator Sharon, if we could just ask till it's, if we could just have it distributed to members.
Still have to get the
Senator Sharon.
The amendment A32 is technical corrections that have been prepared by Mr. Albrecht. what the first correction is on page 22, it modifies the bill language to reflect the changes in the fiscal note. There is in 4 and 5 renumbering on lines 4 and 5 of the amendment. In line 6 is a deletion of Article 3. Article 3 in the omnibus licensing bill is the advanced practice registered nurse portion of the bill, and we will be taking that up as a separate bill, number 511, after we complete this first portion of the bill. So it will be taking the language out of this 1484, and we will take up the bill and the fiscal implications of that when we take up 511.
So does somebody wish to move the 832 amendment? Okay, Senator Goodwin moves to adoption of the 832 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Sharon.
Okay, thank you. To the bill itself, you should have a fiscal note, and it is a consolidated note for the HHS licensing bill. There is language in this that relates to the APRN bill, which we just deleted from the omnibus bill. But there is not any fiscal implications for the portion of this bill related to the Board of Dentistry, but there are fiscal implications related to the Pharmacy Board that you will find more thoroughly described on page 11, and for the Board of Nursing and other health boards on page 16. What is important in relationship to the fiscal note, besides the detail of it, is that all of the expenses associated with the licensing bill are assumed by the boards through their licensing fees and is not a general fund expenditure. And none of the boards are asking for or bringing forward requests to us for fee increases to their members. They will be able to consume the additional costs of these bills in their existing structure.
So, Senator Sharon, let me ask relative to that. First of all, Mr. Nauman points out that on the fiscal note, he's not sure, it's obviously pretty small, that on the special revenue fund for the health department, that's probably not needed, that $2,000, but again, a fairly small expenditure. I want to hear a little bit about the bill, but let me just ask.
Yes, I'd be happy to describe the bill to you.
But relative to the cost, obviously a good deal of what you're doing is in response to a lot of the stories about nurse abuse and so on. But the Board of Nursing does not anticipate any additional hearings, administrative work, or anything else as a consequence of this where they would need more staff to implement whatever you're doing.
There is additional staff identified in the fiscal note. That's part of what for the implementation of the board and Board of Nursing changes, Board of Health changes, and also for the APRN bill later. But the costs of those are able to be covered by their current revenue stream for licensing fees.
Okay. Well, I note that the nursing board, in terms of the special revenue fund, has an increase projected of $661,000 for this year and then approximately $550,000 for the next biennium. That begs the question then as to whether or not the fees are too high to begin with.
So I have representatives from the Board of Nursing who would be able to speak more specifically to their resources. I think it's whether or not. The question is, if this amount of money is absorbable, is it because the fees have been established too high?
Yes.
So could you speak to that?
We've not been advised that our fees are too high.
I'm sorry, if you could identify yourself,
please. I'm sorry. My name is Cheryl Meyer. I'm from the Board of Nursing. Our fees have not been identified as being too high. We're required to have 1.5 times in our operational account, and so we've been able to maintain that balance so far.
Okay, so there's a surplus account or surplus balance that can then be adjusted relative to any new requirements of this legislation. Is that?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. And you're still able to maintain the statutory balance that you need?
Yes.
And does that then continue where you would not expect to either lower or raise fees in the foreseeable future, say over the next, obviously we don't project over the next 5 years, but hypothetically you would anticipate not needing to readjust fees unless there's an unusual increase in the workload as a consequence of this bill?
I don't anticipate that we would need to raise fees. I think as new graduates come on, we continue to get new licenses and generate new fees, renewals of licensure. So we don't anticipate increasing the fee.
Okay. All right, thanks. Well, Senator Sharon, maybe we could just ask for a little bit on the bill and what's going on with it.
Okay. So in the bill itself, there in the first article, there are two areas of discussion. One is changes to the nursing board grounds for disciplinary action. On pages 2 through 6 and 18 through 21, section 1, the language there relates to the health board grounds for disciplinary action. And what the bill, what that language provides is discipline for nurses who do not satisfactorily, let me just back up and restate what you said, Senator Cohen, and that is that this component of the bill, the Board of Nursing bill, has as part of it is responding to a series of criticisms about whether or not the Board of Nursing was able to do adequately what it needed to do to protect the public safety, which is the primary responsibility of the Board of Nursing. It's to make certain that schools of nursing are licensed, making certain that the faculty that teach there are competent and capable of doing that, of making certain those who graduate are competent and pass licensing exams, and then once licensed, that they stay practicing competently, and if they violate their license in any way that they experience a disciplinary process. So there was criticism about that component, that last component of the Board of Nursing. As you know, that the Minnesota Medical Association Board was criticized approximately 2 years before that. I served on a committee that reviewed the Minnesota Medical Association's disciplinary process as well. So this is something that is sort of being challenged. We had a hearing in Health and Human Services over the summer after those articles, and asked the Board of Nursing to come to talk to us about the concerns raised in that article. And they, of course, challenged the accuracy of much of what was in there, but as a result of those hearings, they communicated a willingness to have an audit of their process because they would like to have an opportunity to improve their system. And so, as you know, there will be an audit of the Board of Nursing's disciplinary process in relationship with the health services program. And they also made recommendations to the legislature for additional things that they might do that would strengthen their capacity to carry out their responsibility as a board on the disciplinary role that they play. And that portion, the recommendations from the Board of Nursing as to what authority we can give them, is what's in this section of Article 1 related to the Board of Nursing. And it provides discipline for nurses who do not satisfactorily complete the health professional services program. It allows the board to deny a nurse a license who's been convicted of a felony-level criminal sexual offense. The bill also exempts licenses that have been denied or revoked by the board from the criminal rehabilitation program. And It also increases compensation for not only the Board of Nursing but all health licensing boards from $55 to $75 per day as they engage in board activities. That's in essence at a high level what's in that portion of the bill.
All right, so let me make sure I understand because I've not seen this. And just a comment, it's not my intent to get into a full-fledged discussion that took place within your committee relative to the allegations. I'd suggest, and I'm not sure anybody here on the committee would disagree relative to their situations, but it would be a vast understatement to not suggest that family members and myself have had superb nursing care when needed. I'm not aware of any situation that's ever been brought to my attention by, again, a family or a close friend, whatever, a constituent, of the kinds of stories that were in the newspaper. Nor do I suggest that everything that's printed is absolutely accurate. But the stories as printed were horrific. So what is in your legislation? I mean, you talked about prohibition if somebody's engaged in criminal sexual conduct, for instance. As I recall the stories, I don't know that those weren't necessarily the issues. So what happens if there is a licensed nurse, a hypothetical, who is engaged in behavior, nursing care, that parallels one of the stories, whether correct or not?
Yep.
What happens to that person under this legislation that didn't happen before? Is that person prohibited from ever getting a license again? Is that person kept out of any healthcare facility for 5 years? Or what are the consequences? What does your legislation do?
Well, I will have the member of the board talk more specifically to that. But the bill provides for the bill adds some capacity for the board to get information. Right now, if a nurse, for example, diverts drugs or is let's say they divert drugs, which is some of what was in that article. Or if an employer wants an impaired nurse to be reported to the Board of Nursing for an impairment, that nurse can voluntarily participate in a health services, professional services program. The health professional services program is a monitoring program for health licensed officials, not just nurses, but physicians, other persons who want to continue to practice while they work on a recovery process. But they can do it under the monitoring of this program. And the program defines terms and conditions under which that nurse, in this case, can continue to practice and be closely monitored. So no, there's not an automatic loss of a license. Each of these situations is evaluated by the Board of Nursing, and we have an investment in all our licensees in health from these health boards. These are hugely expensive educations. People spend a lot of time getting prepared to receive these credentials. So we do want to make a commitment to the recovery process for persons in all the health licensing boards. So we have this system built to monitor closely nurses that have failed to meet a certain criteria that allows them to continue to practice and have their income, but also work on a recovery process. This bill, one of the things this bill does is require that if somebody fails to meet the obligations of that management contract, that they be reported back to the Board of Nursing so that the Board of Nursing can engage in a process, again, of protecting the public from a person who's not doing what they need to do to stay safe in their practice. So that's just an example of what is in this bill. And I'd also say not everything that may need to be done is in the bill, because we believe beyond this there may be some recommendations that come from the auditor as to how to strengthen our capacity to protect the public while respecting the fact that there's potential for people to recover from various illnesses. The only situation in which we have a denial of a license is a person convicted of a felony level criminal sexual offense. And I'm going to ask if that is clear enough, we can stop there, or if you'd like more information.
Yeah, I'd like a little bit. So let me just ask relative to crim sex. How about if a county attorney has prosecuted a nurse for maltreatment, that's tantamount to felony assault? What happens with that person?
It's a felony.
If they're convicted of a felony and it's not crim sex, is that person then suspended from practice, or what happens with that person, that hypothetical? So I posed several questions, so just feel free to.
Senator Cohen, members of the committee, my name is Renee Cronquist, and I'm the Director for Practice and Policy at the Board of Nursing, and I oversee the board's disciplinary process. To specifically answer your question, Senator, as Senator Sharon pointed out, the only provision that has an automatic consequence is that relative to the conviction for felony-level criminal sexual misconduct. And that is very parallel with provisions in the Medical Practice Act and the Chiropractic Practice Act. Those boards already had that authority. This is essentially modeled after that. Like the other boards, any other conviction would be reviewed by the board on a case-by-case basis. That's the current structure, and that's not being altered here. The piece that does add some teeth, we think it's quite important, is adding the discharge from HPSP as a grounds for discipline. There's a variety of conduct that could result in one being discharged from the program. In some cases, the individual has returned to use. They've relapsed. And that conduct is addressed in other grounds for discipline. But in other cases, it's merely that they've not cooperated. They've not done the things that they agreed to do or that would otherwise put in those safety provisions that would allow the board to feel comfortable that that individual is safe to practice. That right now is a gap. If somebody's discharged but they've not returned to use, they just perhaps haven't met the requirements of their monitoring agreement, it's an arduous process, and really there's no clear grounds for discipline, and that fixes that hole.
Well, I'm still a little bit it might be unfair to argue from my perspective, kind of glancing around the table. I'm thinking Senator Westrum and myself have a private law practice, and if we take a dollar from our trust account and use it for personal purposes, and these were monies that belonged to a client, we're going to face some pretty significant consequences relative to our license. We don't, depending on what happens, we're not going to get the chance to possibly get our license back. It's possible that we don't get a chance to work something out and continue practicing. We might be suspended from practice. And that's not a matter of life or death. So what happens? You've talked about if somebody has, say, a CD problem, has been stealing drugs at the hospital or from the clinic, and using the drugs for, their addiction. I'm not suggesting that there aren't. It's not appropriate to try to work with somebody like that. But what happens if that behavior results in significant physical maltreatment of the patient? The person is either drunk on the job. Certainly if an airplane pilot is found to even been drinking, whatever the rule is, 12 hours or 24 hours before a flight, that pilot's going to have a tough time flying again. So what are the consequences for a behavior that, and again, Senator Sharon suggested that the news stories, and Senator Sharon, this is my word, were a little bit exaggerated or not, kind of played up the negative as opposed to maybe what the actual reality is. But how about my hypotheticals where somebody's engaged in behavior that really puts somebody at risk? Do we just at some point with that particular nurse say, that's it, you're done? I mean, where do we draw the line? And how do we draw the line? And how does this legislation help us draw the line?
Well, again, Senator Cohen and members of the committee, there none of the boards have very specific bright lines that if there's specific conduct, there's X consequence. And that does include behavior related to chemical dependency, and that does even relate to diversion. Having said that, the board does take diversion very seriously and is very concerned about it and has worked with Senator Sharon and the HPSP to clarify the reporting obligation of the HPSP relative to diversion, such that the board is more likely to know, to know about such behavior. While each case is, again, reviewed on a case-by-case basis, as it must be, the board does take that very seriously, and oftentimes diversion results in a suspension of licensure. Revocation, that is, permanent removal of licensure, is a not common remedy, but it is available to the board. So individuals can be permanently removed from practice.
And how often has that happened the last 5 years?
I don't have that number at my fingertips, Senator Cohen, but I would say that it's increasing. I would say that it's in the neighborhood of about 5 times per year out of about 300 disciplinary actions that the board takes per year. That's off the top of my head, sir, and I can get you a specific
number.
That's
okay. I just wondered in terms of a ballpark figure.
Mm-hmm. But your question, may I say, Senator Cohen, are exactly the questions that we are asking. Because the Board of Nursing really does want to be supported in their role of protecting the public. And the debate, if you had been involved in the earlier meetings, is around, there's pressures from the license holders, as you know, from the legal profession as well, about offering remedy, offering diversion in terms of being able to turn something around. Nurses, theft is another issue of concern because nurses work with very vulnerable people, people who may not be able to communicate that they're being exploited at all or are fearful of complaining because they're dependent on the health care provider. So this is a very vulnerable situation, and we really absolutely want to strengthen and give the board the capacities that they need in order to carry out the job that you're talking about. This improves it. This strengthens it. But we aren't going further in this bill because the main action that we're taking is to have the auditor come in and review the process and take a look at the systems, challenge whether or not what we are doing in the Board of Nursing as it relates to disciplinary action is adequate. Does it meet the board's responsibility to protect the public health? And also its use of the Health Professional Services Program, the relationship with it. You know, that's the very specific purpose for which we really lobbied for that the Board of Nursing review by the auditor be one of the options that our legislature chose this year. The announcement came out yesterday that it will. So I expect that there'll be more coming before us in relationship to this, some ideas.
Other questions from the committee? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment when we get to that appropriate point.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, on the fiscal note, it looks at health-related boards fund, and it goes from 291 to 493. I take it that's the extra money per diem that's being added to the boards. Is that correct?
Some of that money is there is a request for an increase of the compensation for board health licensing boards only from $55 to $75 a day, but that does not account for that total number.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Senator Sharon, so could you tell us what is also involved in that number then, as far as the extra 493 in the next biennium?
If you look on page 11 of the consolidated fiscal note, you will begin to see the provisions for the expenditures for the components of this bill related to the Board of Pharmacy, which I haven't gone through with you yet. And then on page 16 begins a more explicit description of the Health Licensing Board provisions that are noted in this bill. And because we deleted the language related to the APRN, those expenditures are no longer included in this total number. So let's see, I can maybe direct you to the specific page that describes. As you can see, on the Health Licensing Boards, it goes through each of the boards and defines the expenditures per board. I don't know if you want me to go through all of that, Senator.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Senator Sharon, with deleting Article 3, how much does that pull out of the that number we're talking about? Do you know?
Is Mr. Albrecht here? Maybe he could help with the specifics of this. I know I saw him here earlier. There he is.
Mr. Albrecht?
As Mr. Albrecht looks at that, I would want to be clear that that number will still be a part of this presentation because we will be dealing with that expenditure when we take up 511. None of this has to do with 511.
Mr. Albrecht, do you?
Mr. Chair, hold on just a sec.
Are you asking?
Senator Anderson?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, you said that Article 3 was taken out of the bill and that
Yes. Even
though it was taken out, I just wanted to know what portion of the dollars that are on this were in Article 3. That you're taking, even though we're going to be explaining it later in another bill.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, what is taken out by taking out the APRN provisions is the $378,000 of net expenditures for the nursing board. And the $661,000 of revenues for the nursing board.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Albrecht, is that noted on the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, no, because the fiscal note was prepared before the amendment was adopted. But in your packet, Senator Anderson, is the fiscal note for Senate File 511, which is what I'm looking at to figure out what was taken out by the amendment.
Okay.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, I would move the A31 amendment.
Okay, if we could have that distributed.
Mr. Chair, this is a licensing issue for the Belgrade nursing home in my district.
Senator Westrum, if we could just wait till it's distributed
okay. For
just a minute. Thanks.
And Senator Cohen, there's more in this bill that I have not described while that's being distributed. There's a dental licensing program provisions.
I forgot. Senator Westrum?
I'll withdraw my amendment.
Right yeah, when I started getting into my questions, I forgot that Senator Sharon had said there were some other things she wanted to talk about in the bill. So let's have Senator Sharon go through the bill, and then we'll have the amendment distributed, and we'll go back to you right away.
Sure.
Thanks. Senator Sharon.
So in Article 1, as I said, there are two components. It's the grounds for disciplinary action modifications, which we've just discussed, but also in Article 1 on page 6 through 18 of the bill, sections 4 through 17, are dental licensing provision modifications. And these modifications remove the American Dental Association references when referring to the Commission on Dental Accreditation. It clarifies what CPR training is appropriate for dentists and dental assistants and for restorative dental hygienists. It eliminates the Board of Dentistry's ability to waive the clinical exam for some of their applicants. It increases fees for the professional development portfolio audits twice. And and that's, in essence, what this component of the bill does. If you have any questions, we have a representative of that board here as well. And then I could go forward.
Yep.
Article
yep,
two
go
is the there are in Article two, which is for your bill, is on pages 23 through 73. There are a number of pharmacy board provisions and modifications and clarifications. And then on page 74 through 82 of Article two is the prescription monitoring program modifications. And to describe those, in the first portion, the Board of Pharmacy bill contains conforming language. This is the section of the bill on pages 23 through 73. This is the pharmacy board provision modifications. It strengthens the standards for the immunizations that are provided by pharmacists. There have been concerns expressed about the safety of this practice, so the board and the Department of Health have worked for a number of years to address the safety issues, and the language in this bill is the result of those 3 years of effort. It makes easier pharmacists' ability to enter into collaborative agreements with practitioners, making the team care approach more accessible to pharmacists. It updates the board's disciplinary statute pursuant to the Attorney General's recommendations, which had noted that their statute related to the disciplinary process was decades old. It changes the definition of drug in the statute, which is amended to capture synthetic drugs without targeting legal products that use synthetic drugs. And so this change focuses on drugs that are not regulated by the FDA. Gives the board authority to issue and enforce cease and desist orders when violating the law. This is in relationship to a particular product that a pharmacist might be selling without closing down an entire shop. It makes explicit the sale of these drugs are illegal. This has to do with compounding drugs, the issues that were in the press about that. And it removes the requirement of legislative ratification for adding drugs to a schedule when the legislature is not in session. So it allows a more rapid action that the pharmacy board needs in order to deal with continually and changing substances that are available. All right, so that's the first provision, which is the Board of Pharmacy. Then the second portion of this, which is on pages 6 through 18, this is the prescription monitoring program language. This makes changes to the prescription monitoring program that the Board of Pharmacy feels is necessary to respond to recommendations that have come from the Department of Human Services, that there should be an increase of pharmacists and prescribers in the pharmacy prescription monitoring program. So the changes include requiring prescriptions for Schedule 5 controlled substances to be reported to the prescription monitoring program. It requires reports of controlled substances dispensed to those in long-term care facilities, in hospices, or receiving home-based services. This is a new reporting process. Allows prescribers and pharmacists to access the prescription monitoring program for medically valid reasons instead of only when they are prescribing a controlled substance. It expands the responsibility of the task force to include advising on triggers of unsolicited reports and drugs that may have to be reported. It allows the retention of data for 5 years, but it only allows access to the data older than 12 months to administer the program and identify trends. We're trying to find a way to use the data to identify trends and deal with problems that we are having with prescription of pain medications. And allows the health licensing boards to access the prescription monitoring program when they have a complaint which alleges a criminal activity. So it allows the licensing boards access to this information. So, you know, that's primarily the provisions in this. Of course, Cody Weiberg is here from the Board of Pharmacy if you have any further questions on those two provisions in Article 2.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you, Senator Sharon. So, Senator Westrom, we've had distributed the 831 amendment.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I'd move that at this time.
So we have Senator Westrom's motion. You were starting to explain the amendment.
Mr. Chair, this amendment would deal with a licensing issue at the Belgrade Nursing Home, who has a small assisted living attached to it and has had it for several years, since 1988. With some licensing changes that went on last year's bills, they are now required to get yet another license and fill out more paperwork, and this would give them an exemption from that. It used to be handled through the county. I understand the department has no problems with this, and there's no fiscal cost. I've mentioned it to Chair Laurie, and he had advised me to put it on one of these bills, this bill instead of the finance bill, where it was more appropriate. And I don't believe he has any concern or problem with it, but I don't want to speak for him. Of course, he's sitting next to me. Yeah. And Senator Sharon, I believe this was shared with your staff as well. So,
Senator Westrom did share this with me, but I received some feedback that there was a fiscal implication, and I also heard from the Department of Health that they were not supportive of the amendment. So I would just give that information. This did not go through my committee. Did not go through Senator Laurie's finance committee, and I communicated to Senator Westrom. He was generous to show this to me ahead of time, this information, that we had heard that there was a fiscal implication and that the Department of Health that does the licensing of these facilities is not supportive of this amendment.
And is the department's objection a financial one, because there is a fiscal cost, or on a matter of policy?
Mr. Chair, I guess I need to maybe ask our Senate counsel, because they're the ones that had contacted this department on my behalf, and that was the message. So the fiscal note cost is either a change of heart or a different person communicating something different than what we were originally told. And Mr. Chair, this came up to me last week when the nursing home administrator was down here, and so it's one of those issues that last year's legislation has impacted their issue, and the switch from the county to the state has caused this issue, and so that's the reason for the amendment at this time. But Senator Sharon, if there's a new information from the department, I guess we need to visit with them further. But Mr. Chair, I would commit to working with Chair Sharon on this. The department's, that's not the information I was originally told, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any comment from the agency?
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman, the budget director with the Health Department. We had seen this amendment last week, and I think we did indicate to Senate counsel that there was no fiscal impact. We since then fiscal noted a amendment that was written more broadly that would have affected more facilities. We did fiscal note that and showed an impact. However, this language doesn't have a fiscal impact.
Separate from your creative use of fiscal as a verb, do we know what the fiscal impact is?
Mr. Chair, what would happen if this facility were to decide not to be licensed is we would not be collecting a fee from it for licensing, and we would also not be incurring costs to do the regulations, to respond to complaints, to do the inspection, and the other activities related to regulating these facilities.
Mr. Nauman, do you?
Mr. Chair, I've had a chance to visit with Mr. Albrecht. It's his understanding. I think
you need to speak up a little bit.
Mr. Chair, I've had a chance to visit with Mr. Albrecht about this, and I believe it's his understanding that it's a de minimis amount, so not even trackable.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Westrom.
Maybe that helps explain the confusion. I did have a broader amendment, and it was the advice of counsel that this narrow amendment did not have cost. And so I think that Senator Sharon might be where the confusion is. This is not the broader amendment that would give more facilities in this similar situation. If there are, they will have to come forward separately, where this one is narrowly drawn and wouldn't be the broad amendment.
And then Senator Cohen, the department would like to speak to the public the policy implications of this amendment as well.
Certainly.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Division of Compliance Monitoring in the Health Department. We license nursing homes and regulate and license home care providers and also register housing with services, which are also affected by this proposal. We do have several concerns about this proposed amendment because it would exempt one or several nursing homes that are also providing home care services in an adjacent apartment building from the legal requirements for home care services, and also would exempt these providers from the oversight of the health department without any other way of having oversight over these services. The amendment specifically applies to nursing homes that were open in 1988. We're aware of one nursing home that fits that description. There could be others, but we're not sure. If that applies to 10 units or less, as is in the proposed amendment, that could affect up to perhaps 20 consumers. The effect of the amendment exempts, as I said, the providers from the home care requirements and from our oversight. Our oversight would include those regular inspections, having complaint line and conducting complaint investigations and investigating complaints, taking enforcement actions if required. So we consider this proposed amendment difficult, and I guess that's I'm trying to think of what other things are on my sheet. But and then to the question that Senator Westrom raised about this being a new change in law, the home care requirements have been in effect. We've been regulating home care providers since 1987, and the exemptions and exclusions were not changed during that time. So we're unclear as to why this home care provider is unaware of the home care provider requirements. So the information that this is something new is we're not sure what to make of that.
Okay. Senator Westrom?
Mr. Chair, I guess I will ask of the department to come and share this with me afterwards. But, Mr. Chair, what my constituent and their organization have communicated to me is the change went into effect January of this year by the department. Priorly, they were the oversight was with the county, and the county had not required them to have a license, and they already do hold the home care license and a nursing home license. And where this apparently this new license issue comes into play is if they step in to the assisted living, which is attached, there's six units attached to their nursing home. So if they walk across the hall and disseminate or help one of the residents organize their pills, or maybe the daughter is out of town for the weekend, so they offer to help change catheter bags or something like that, it requires them to have this license where the county before was not. This, so long as they have a nursing home license and a home health care license, this is exempting them from getting yet another license and paperwork, which the incentive is for them just not to offer that assistance to the resident's family when they intermediately need that care. And so what the department is describing is some different, but I'm happy to visit with them, but that is a situation that has changed.
All right, we have the A31 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries.
Division
has been requested. All those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. Those opposed, please raise your hand. On a vote of 7-7, the motion fails. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. That completes the components of the licensing bill since we have deleted Article 3.
Is there further discussion on Senate File 1484? Does anyone wish to move the bill? Senator Laurie moves that Senate File 1484 as amended be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Are you prepared to go to 511?
Okay.
Yes. Okay.
Senator Laurie moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. Senate File 511 is a bill that is directed at improving patient access to the advanced practice nurses for Minnesotans. This bill is the result of numerous drafts that allows APRNs to practice to the full extent of their training and education. Current law requires APRNs to practice in settings where they have a physician or a group of physicians who've agreed to work with the APRNs to manage care. And what this bill does is clarify, this is a complicated bill. Let me back up here a little bit. This bill begins to develop a process by which it is clear what the APRN designation means, what the educational requirements are in order to be able to be licensed as an APRN. It authorizes language that changes what was a collaborative management and collaborative written agreement, and it amends specialty penalties for APRNs. In the multiple versions of this bill, we've been able to find language that is agreeable to many stakeholders as it relates to the scope of practice of APRNs. Might I start to, without trying to confuse everybody, indicate that within the APRN designation, there are a variety of certifications. They include clinical nurse specialists, family nurse practitioners, midwives, and certified registered nurse anesthetists. So elements of this bill relate to those various modes, I guess you could say, of practice as advanced practice nurses. One of the things that would be helpful to me at this time is if the committee would adopt the A14 amendment. These are technical changes to the bill that passed out of Senator Laurie's Health Finance Committee last week.
If we could have the amendment distributed.
To the amendment. At the last hearing in Health and Human Services Finance, Senator Laurie's committee, we implemented particularly under the strong support for resolving issues from Senator Laurie, a number of amendments to this bill. This language puts into technically correct language the final amendment that was made to the bill late in the evening, and only addresses and reorganizes the language that was approved in the committee at that time. The only addition to this that was not in the amendment on at the hearing, which was Thursday or Friday last week, can't remember when it was, is that we identify I'm looking very hard to see if it is in here. We intended to include language that increases the clinical hours post certification from 2000 to 2080. So on line point 1.21, you'll see the number 2080 hours, and that is a change that was a result of further conversations that I had since Senator Lori's hearing. Which brings the supervisory process post-graduation to an actual year rather than just 2,000 hours.
Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Sharon has accurately represented this as a technical cleanup to an amendment that came very, very late in our division. We spent an entire day on this. So I think this gets to the technical aspects of what was agreed to in our committee. I think that I should say I don't think it brings everybody into agreement on exactly where we should be. This cleans up the technical piece of where we wanted to be when we left the committee. Okay.
So the new language, which is substantive in the amendment, is not necessarily technical but clarifies language that your division did.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, and it is our intention to have the parties of interest continue their conversation to improve this particular section in the bill. It's the last section of the bill that continues to be in conversation. But this is the spirit of the agreement. So further conversations will be occurring with the interested parties about this section of the bill. But the essential spirit of this is my expectation in those conversations.
All right, is there further discussion? If not, Senator Lori moves adoption of the A14 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Sharon.
Okay, so there is a fiscal note associated with this segment of the bill. And how would you like me to proceed at this point?
If you'd like to direct our attention to it, is
Mr. Albrecht here?
Okay. So Senator Sharon, maybe a similar question as to what I had with your previous bill. This shows a reduction of special revenue funds. With the bill, is that simply an adjustment then of the balance that's been carried forward?
Thank you. I will, if you don't mind, I'll have the board members who are working with their budgetary process answer your questions.
Thank you. Could you clarify the question again?
Well, the fiscal note indicates a reduction in costs and a savings of, if I've read this correctly, of $283,000 in this biennium and a smaller amount in the next biennium. Is that all then taken into account with what you had described earlier in terms of the carry forward with the fund balance you have?
Senator Cohen, I just would notice while you're thinking up an answer that the revenue, under the revenue section, you'll see that the revenue exceeds the cost. So there's an adjustment in the total cost savings to against the number of total revenues.
Just a small clarification.
Okay.
Does that answer the question? Or
yeah. Yes.
It's that initial licensure that would create the...
So it's the additional revenue.
Right.
Okay. All right. You've clarified that. Thank you. Other questions on the fiscal note? Senator Sharon?
Are there other questions on the fiscal note?
Anything, I asked the committee, so okay. I didn't see any hands, so turn it back over to you.
If there aren't any further questions on the bill itself, and they understand okay. that this, again, is something that is not carried in the general fund, it's paid for out of the revenues of the Board of Nursing.
All right.
From licensing fees.
All right. Any further discussion on Senate File 511? Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, is there any opposition to your bill?
There has been
medical community.
Excuse me?
From the medical community, health providers.
There is, we have a scope of practice bill in front of us, so as we've been moving through the process, there have been a number of efforts between the parties to find language that meets the interests of all parties at hand. And this is a multiple reiterations of negotiations. So I don't know if that's what you mean by opposition. I think that what is here is agreed to, accepting this last provision. We have the spirit of what is intended for the CRNAs who do chronic pain management. But the agreement that I have with the parties is that they are hopefully going to be able to continue to talk and even improve that final language before we get to the floor. My position is that we've been working on this language now for about 5 years, and we're very close. We're at the very tail of this in terms of coming to an agreement. But the essential principles and boundaries are in this last amendment that you just have given us, and we may tweak that a bit, but the essence of it is in place. Is everybody happy? Everybody has come to an agreement. Well, that's not completely true. We've agreed to this language, and we're continuing to see if we can even improve it more before it gets to the floor.
Senator Limmer.
It's probably unfair of me to ask Senator Sharon to ask if there's any opposition to a bill that she's a proponent of. Maybe the question I should have asked is there anyone in the room that would be in opposition to the bill before we vote on it?
Well, Senator Limmer, if you're asking if anybody would like to testify on the bill, I have not received notice anybody wants to testify. I don't see anybody jumping up. Is there further discussion or questions about Senate File 511? If not, anybody wish to move the bill? Senator Pappas? Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 511 as amended be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. And then, Senator Sharon, you've got Senate File 1890.
Yes, that's the Board of Nursing language again. I'm simply asking that we be able to carry that separately as well as amended.
Okay,
to the floor.
Senator Laurie moves the division report for Senate File 1890. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Sharon.
It is, Senator Cohen, it is going as amended, right?
The
motion was as amended. Excuse me, Senator Cohen, apparently I need to offer a completely different amendment.
We adopted the division report. If there's a separate amendment, why don't you explain what this bill is?
The bill is exactly the same language that's in the omnibus licensing bill. There's no changes to it, but apparently Mr. Albrecht thinks that we should again pass the amendment to this bill that we've already passed in the omnibus bill.
So we have an incorrect fiscal note in the packet. What is?
And he's coming to help me see what that is.
Okay.
Which is again stating that the page 2, line 10, we changed the number because there was a revision in the fiscal note from $278,000 to $258,000 around cost of leasing space. So I guess we need to have that
So, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair, the point that concerns me a little, this is, I believe, the newest fiscal note that we have. However, I'm led to believe that it may not be the correct fiscal note for this particular bill. It's showing a $19,000 fiscal impact in the general fund with tails. So, with your permission, I'd like to take a couple of minutes to talk with MMB and see whether or not I can run that down. I think I can.
And Mr. Nauman, now it looks like the significant increase is with the Board of Engineering. Is that
correct? So I don't see. I just want a couple minutes to chat about it. I think we can run this down quickly.
Okay. Well, Senator Sharon?
Yes.
Unless you have something to offer, let me suggest this. Unless it's going to be very quick.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think our packet's a victim of a whole bunch of moving paper. I've been handed a fiscal note that I believe is now the most current, dated 4/10. I can tell you that there's a $2,000 net expenditure with tails in the state government special revenue fund, $362 for the health-related boards, no revenue effect. So those numbers that I cited represent the net effect an increase, but it's state government special revenue funds and health-related boards. I think it's consistent with the previous bill. So if you're comfortable with what I've just put on the record,
yeah.
I think you can proceed.
I think that's satisfactory. So, Senator Sharon, you've had distributed the A9 amendment. Maybe just indicate what that is.
This language puts the language of the bill in line with the most current fiscal note.
All right. Does anybody wish to move that? Senator Tomasoni moves adoption of the A9 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Sharon, anything further on 1890?
No. We've already discussed this bill, so we're just asking that it move separately to the floor.
Okay. Any further discussion? Does anybody wish to move the bill?
Okay,
Senator Wigger moves that Senate File 1890, as amended, be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you very much,
Senator Sharon.
I have another bill, but Senator Jensen's agreed to present it for me later
Fine.
Today.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. Thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Jensen, I hate to pick and choose. Senator Johnson has been sitting there very calmly, and I know Senator Johnson's enjoyed being in the committee all morning. So, and I think she has a couple of witnesses. So if that's okay, Senator Jensen. So we have Senate File 1978, Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1978 is a women veterans license plate bill. With me today is...
And, Senator, I'm sorry. Senator Tomasoni moves adoption of the division report.
Okay.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much. There were some changes made in the Senator Saxog's committee. This is a women's license plate bill for veterans, women veterans. Have with me today Jill Troutner and Trista Mattis Castillo. I have to think on that one, who are former military people. But what this bill does is allows the 29,000 people in Minnesota, women veterans, to be able to have a license plate that would designate that they were former military. The women in Minnesota have been participating many, many years, and they want to be recognized on their own. Most of the time, I think all of you would agree that when you see a veteran's license plate on a car, you think of a man. And I do the same thing. But but this will allow them to have their own special plate. Also, Ms. McCormick, Director at the Driver and Vehicle Services Division, is here today if you have any questions. Jill and Trista are also available if you have any questions or would like some additional testimony. It passed out of the Senator Saxog's committee without any opposition.
Okay. Thank you. And obviously, I think what's become apparent in the last, if not 20 years, 10 years, 15 years, certainly with the Gulf War, what women have done relative to the security, the defense of the country. But would the witnesses like to testify on the bill? If you might just identify yourself for the record and just be delighted to have your comments.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Senators. Thank you for your time today. My name is Jill Troutner. I'm a resident of Maple Grove, and I grew up on White Earth Indian Reservation. When I was a high school senior, I was nominated by the late Congressman Arlen Stanglin to attend West Point. I graduated with the class in 1993, a defender of the free. I served in Germany as part of a forward support battalion, and I also competed as a soldier athlete in USA Biathlon and military biathlon. I made my way home to Minnesota and joined the Minnesota National Guard, and as so many Minnesotan guardsmen do, I deployed with them. Looking at my fellow women veterans and myself, we don't stand out from the rest of the citizens. And I was shocked when I found out that there are over 29,000 Minnesota veteran women in my state. I don't see them. We're invisible. I thought I was just amongst a handful of women. For these women, having a woman veterans plate is a long overdue acknowledgement of their service, and it's something visual that cannot be mistaken for anyone's but their own. Everyone notices that veterans plate, especially veterans, and everyone, myself included, assume that plate belongs to a man. For me, this license plate, it's a statement of value, that my state values my contributions, my sacrifices, and my patriotism in a highly visible way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just identify yourself, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Trista Mattis Castillo. I, too, am a veteran. I served in the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Army National Guard for a total of 16 years. I just wanted to add, you mentioned that women have been serving most in the news in the last 15 or 20 years since Desert Storm, but here with us we have many other women veterans, some who served in Vietnam as well, and we have a large population of World War II women veterans here in Minnesota too. Women have been serving alongside our male counterparts since the Revolutionary War, and we have been unrecognized and often left in the shadows. After World War II, we had many women that served, including one of my favorite women veterans, Betty Strofus, who was a fighter pilot in World War II. She wasn't intended to be a fighter pilot. She was flying planes that when she landed on the ship, they loaded with bombs. There's only one way to get bombs off an aircraft, and that's to drop them. So she became a fighter pilot, the first woman fighter pilot, all the way back in World War II, and she's here in Minnesota. And Betty is 90. She's still driving, and she's very cognizant, and she's very eager to see an opportunity to be recognized for her service and to have a woman veteran's license plate.
Thank you. And I don't want to suggest by my comments to apologize for the inference you might have drawn that I think all of us are aware that women have been involved with the armed services for the duration of the country's history, but I think certainly the attention paid has been more recent, which just simply makes the point as to why we ought to pass this legislation and allow that recognition to be made more publicly. Questions for the witnesses? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I notice it looks like the design is not done yet, and what it would say, I'm just interested. What would a plate likely say, or do you have any designs of other states that have done this? And what would be different on this one?
If anybody can answer.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, that's a great – we have not yet designed. We wanted to get through this process. There are 16 other veterans plates across the country that we can take a look at, women veterans plates and designs. But our goal here is to not make some fancy, outstanding new plate that's flashy, but really to have the word woman on the plate. So in front of the word veteran, if you see a veteran's plate, it says veteran. Sometimes it says Iraq or Vietnam or an error or some other thing, and we would like the word woman on that plate at a minimum. But we'll work in partnership with the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Transportation to design a plate that's appropriate.
Sure. Thank you.
Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Johnson, to the veterans. I'm a proud dad of one of those 29,000 women vets. She was at Fort Jackson, and 9/11 occurred, and soon deployed to Iraq. She's a social worker now in Minnesota, very proud to be a veteran, and you're right, most would assume it's a male when they see that veteran with that license plate. And so, Mr. Chair, if I could move Senate File 1978.
Certainly. Is there other further discussion or questions? Senator Latz.
Maybe this is something of a generational thing, but I don't make that assumption. I just don't. I mean, I see veteran. I don't know if it's a male or a female. I don't make that assumption.
He's so young.
For what it's worth, I don't think it's necessary, but I don't have opposition to the concept itself. I've got opposition to the proliferation of these specialty plates. So this is, what, the second one we've heard in this committee this year? There's another one on the agenda today?
Yes.
Or it was already heard? Maybe it happened before I got here. I mean, at this rate, we're going to have 1,000, 1,500 specialty plates in Minnesota. I just don't understand why every group that wants to be specially recognized feels they've got to have a license plate to show it to the world. So I've got nothing at all against women veterans. I admire them terrifically like I do all veterans, but I think the whole concept of these specialty plates is just completely out of hand. And I'll be opposing it just for that reason alone.
Okay, do we have further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, I think I had the same initial reaction because we've seen a lot of plates develop over the years, and that's a good observation that you make. I was visited by my constituent, Ms. Troutner, and outside the Senate chamber the other day, and my first question was, well, I thought we have veteran plates. And she was very quick to clarify that we do have veteran plates, but we designate them in a different manner. We have quite a few veteran plates, and I was kind of educated on the issue. We have World War II plates. We have Vietnam. We have Desert Storm, Desert Shield, I think. I don't know. It's confusing. But at the same time, we kind of lump them or make the assumption, and without maybe even knowing it, we fail to recognize the unique contributions of the growing role of women in our military. And I think this is an appropriate license plate to designate. I think we will probably address the issue of how far do we go on license plates in the near future, but right now I think these ladies deserve the recognition that they earned, and we're grateful for that.
And Senator Latz, I think I share your concern in terms of, you know, the number of license plates. I guess I kind of draw a line. If we're looking at license plates as political statements or something of that sort, I would certainly be opposed. If we're doing it for honorary purposes of something unusual, extraordinary, then I'm certainly willing to look at that qualification. And that's kind of my distinction.
Mr. Chairman.
Is there further discussion, Senator Tomasoni?
Mr. Chairman, I'm confused as to why people think that there's a problem with specialty plates. I mean, it says State of Minnesota on it. It's a license plate on the car. If somebody wants to pay a little bit extra because they want to honor somebody like the women veterans, I think it's totally appropriate. And we have 86 specialty plates, and I think I heard 200 different designs or something like that, so we're not even close to 1,000 or 1,500, Senator Latz. But,
at this rate, this session, we're going to get there.
I actually have an amendment here for a retired firefighter's plate, but I'm not going to offer it. But in this particular case, there is a firefighter's plate, but when they retire, they have to take it off their car because it allows them access to an active fire. And so They actually can't use their firefighter's plate after they retire, so it would make all the sense in the world to put a little retired sticker on it. And I don't know if you're thinking of putting a woman sticker on these plates or not, but whatever the case may be, I support this, and I think that good causes like this, if people want to put it on their license plate, we should definitely honor their desire to do so.
Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson.
And Senator Latz, I feel like I want to respond, because these women have testified and have told me how when they, like, go get the free lunch on Veterans Day at Applebee's or wherever they're offering, they walk in and they don't get treated as a veteran. They want to know where their husband is. They have a plate on their, a veteran plate on, and they immediately, people say, oh, what war was your husband in? And so it's very typical. And, you know, when it happens to you, and you've I have never been in the military, but, you know, if that would happen to me, I would think it would be very important that I would be recognized as a person who might have been disabled or threatened, life-threatening circumstances and so forth. I think it's only right that women should be made known, because I think women are going to be in the military. There's going to be a greater and greater percentage of military people who will be women. So I just have to say that in defense of
their request. And, Senator Johnson, I would suggest that, just from my perspective, that's well taken. I just parenthetically, we had a bill 2 or 3 weeks ago in the Rules Committee that was authored by Senator Anderson relative to Gold Star families, and it was an interesting discussion, and Senator Hand moved the bill and pointed out that he was the only veteran of all of us on the Rules Committee, so it's different from earlier generations. And obviously the Rules Committee are the senior members of the Senate, and I'm not sure how many people were there, if there were 10, 12 of us, but Senator Hand was it as a veteran. So further discussion, okay, if not, Senator Wieger moves that Senate file 1978 Senate file 1978 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Johnson. Thank you for testifying.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. And then if we're not going to upset Senator Latz too much, we have Senate file 2071. And Senator Jensen, you're going to present this as a co-author on behalf of Senator Sharon. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Saxog moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Currently, we have a wounded warrior plate that's already in existence that we've been using for some time. What this bill does is it asks that we could take the same plate, the design work, and shrink it down so that the wounded veterans would be able to use that plate on their motorcycles. And that is what this bill does. So design has already been, we already use it in cars. This would just be used for motorcycles. The design has already been made. It would just be shrunk down to be able to be utilized.
Okay. Do we have further discussion? Senator Westrom.
I was just going to move the bill.
Yeah. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I'm half chuckling over here, just asking the question, do we really have to pass legislation to shrink down a license plate to a motorcycle?
Yes.
I assume that answer is a Red Barn question, and it's yes, but it does just make me wonder if we have to legislate everything. To me, it makes sense. I mean, if we've already have the plate, shrink it down so it fits on a motorcycle, you don't want to car-sized license plate on a motorcycle. So I think that makes sense. Kind of related to the last testimony, I understand where Senator Latz is coming from. I've had those reservations before. I also I think Senator Tomasoni makes good sense, and I'm starting to evolve to say if it's a good cause, you know, so what if we get to 1,000? There are at least license plates that give identification for cars. But this sounds like a common sense to me, Senator Jensen, and I'm just kind of – I'm not trying to make light of it. I just in light of the prior conversation, for us to have to legislate to put a mini version of the same plate out is a little bit ironic.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, currently there are 5 under motorcycle, and this would add the description of in the other statute where the vehicle plate is and move it into the section under motorcycle, and it would be 6.
So, Mr. Chair, I mean, maybe this isn't the bill to do it, but Senator Jensen and members, I mean, I foresee 86 other or 80 other plates coming forward to say, can we shrink ours down to fit on a motorcycle? And I think maybe that would be a friendly amendment on the floor that just says if it's an approved plate, they can license a motorcycle if we require a license on the vehicle. Just food for thought.
Okay. Is there further discussion on the bill? Does anybody wish to move the bill? Senator Saxhog moves that Senate file 2071 be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Jensen.
Thank you.
Members, if members don't mind, because we do have now bills on the committee, I have a small bill and I have a couple of people here. So, Senator Latz, do you have witnesses on your bills?
Some are available, but neither of them are controversial as far as I'm aware, Mr. Chair.
Well, a few people.
I think your bill is already in the judiciary budget articles.
Right, but I've got the bill itself. But a few people here, and you want to go ahead, then
don't worry about it. Go ahead, Mr.
Okay.
Welcome, Senator Cohen. We have before us Senate File 1922. Senator Latz moves the division report.
I'll introduce it.
All those in favor indicate aye.
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 Carried. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is a fairly simple bill, and I thought I had a couple people here. Senator, but there is a small cost that we should talk about. Well, I suppose I should have. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think they're just outside. This is a fairly simple bill. It takes the previous appropriation on a carry-forward basis. This is money used for law enforcement agencies to allow officers to be trained relative to sex trafficking. And we've had some considerable attention paid to that over the last couple of years. We provided money for this purpose. This simply allows this money to be carried forward to the end of the biennium, and we need the additional time to facilitate the training. It's not been completed. So it's as simple as that. We have somebody from the Post Board. I thought we had some people from the county attorney's office who I had seen earlier. And the bill is as simple as that. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate File 1922.
Okay, on Senator Cohen's motion, I'll first ask, is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 1922 before we take action?
No.
Is there any amendment?
Okay.
Discussion? There being none, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Cohen.
Okay, thank you. And then we've got two bills. If you want to continue to chair, we have two bills of Senator Latz.
Senator Latz, Senate File 2480, Imprisonment and Exoneration Remedies Act. Senator Latz moves the division report for Senate File 2480. All in favor indicate aye. Opposed? Carried. Senator Latz, I believe you have an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have two amendments.
Okay, we'll distribute those when you wish. Please proceed.
Well, you can go ahead. Distribute the A11 amendment if you would.
Okay, A11 will be distributed. As it's being distributed, would you like to give a brief overview of the bill?
Yes, please, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill sets up a mechanism for compensating those persons that have been convicted of a crime in Minnesota, have served time in state prison, and are later exonerated from having committed that crime. Their conviction is overturned or vacated, and a determination is made that, in fact, it is unlikely that they ever committed the crime in the first place, and thereby had improperly spent time in state prison. The most classic example nationally would be a DNA exoneration, where someone spends 20 years in prison and they find out somewhere down the road they've got new scientific techniques to evaluate evidence, and they go back to the old evidence and they find out that there is no way possible that the person who's been in prison could have committed the crime that that person was convicted of, and the person gets released. Well, fortunately, we haven't had any of those kinds of exonerations in Minnesota, but we have had two more recent incidents in the last several years of exoneration. One, which did get a lot of media attention, had to do with the Toyota acceleration pedal recall, where a person was convicted of having accelerated on a highway off-ramp and rear-ended another vehicle, killing some people. And it was later determined that that person should have the conviction overturned because it turns out Toyota, unknown at the time of the conviction, Toyota was having mechanical problems with its accelerator. Another instance had to do with a person that was convicted of killing his young infant. And as it turned out, about 7 years after he started serving his prison sentence, that the overwhelming medical evidence brought to the conclusion that the injuries from which the infant died had been sustained several days before the occurrence that led to the conviction of the individual. And he was also released from prison, the conviction being overturned. Those two instances, along with some other information that had led me at one point while chair of the Claims Committee to come across a case in Minnesota that suggested there might be something like this, led to the Minnesota Innocence Project to prepare legislation to address these kinds of situations in Minnesota. As it happens, there are 29 other states and the federal government and the District of Columbia that already have similar compensation statutes on their books, and so this will add Minnesota to the group of states. The A11 amendment that you have in front of you is a result of some ongoing negotiations with the County Attorneys Association, the Minnesota Innocence Project, the courts, and some others as to exactly how this all ought to be handled. And it also includes a mechanism by which we would not have any or a very minimal fiscal note. So I do have a follow-up amendment that we would put on that would bring the fiscal note down to $3,000 for MMB. So if you wish, I can give you a brief summary of the mechanism by which this would take place. A person would have to have their conviction vacated or reversed and or have a new trial ordered by a judge and the prosecutor dismissing the charges and all appeal times having expired. And then there would be a procedure for bringing a motion for exoneration brought before the same judge that handled the vacation of the conviction. If that is granted, then there could be a separate proceeding for compensation to be based upon innocence or in certain circumstances without establishing innocence because of newly discovered evidence. There's some definitions of the evidence. If a judge were to determine that a person qualified, then a compensation process itself would begin, and that would be determined by a special panel of three persons appointed by the state Supreme Court. There are guidelines for what that compensation could be. Established at least $50,000 per year of incarceration, capped at a total of $100,000 per year, considering not only the year of the years of incarceration, but also other factors related to the significance of that particular case. There's a provision that would qualify such an exoneration for expungement. It sets a statute of limitations in place of 2 years. Basically 2 years after the order is issued, or under certain circumstances, if they didn't have appropriate notice, 3 years. It sets up the panel process for review, a pre-hearing settlement process as well, and a mechanism for reimbursement of costs and expenses and fees relating to seeking that compensation. So that's the basic process, members. So I ask that the committee adopt the A11 amendment, and with this process, there would not be any fiscal impact, but for a minor one, which I will address in the A12 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Senator Newman, then Senator Lemmer. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is a bill that we did here in the Judiciary Committee, and I will just mention to the members that it is a bill that I do support, and I want to thank Senator Latz for bringing it forward. But if you could, Senator Latz, the A11 amendment is a delete-all amendment. Could you point out for us the specific sections or subdivisions? You don't necessarily have to explain them at this point, but if you could point out to us the difference between the A11 amendment and the bill that we heard in Judiciary, so I could just zero in on it without trying to it would just help me if you would.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, the key changes are that Section 1 rewrites the process for determining whether an individual is eligible for bringing that claim for based on exoneration, and it sets forth a two-stage process with some more detail in it. The original bill only included a general reference to innocence. So Section 1 gives a little more delineation of what exactly that means, a little more guidance then to the district court judge making that determination. The first stage of the process will be a determination of whether the individual is exonerated, and that includes the definition of exoneration. And it would occur as part of the post-conviction relief petition. And then the second stage would be a determination regarding whether or not that exonerated individual is eligible to bring a claim for compensation. And then there are two categories set forth for that qualification. One is if the compensation is based on innocence, where a petitioner establishes by preponderance of the evidence that a crime was not committed, or that the crime was not committed by the petitioner, or secondly, without establishing innocence, where newly discovered evidence was the basis for exoneration and the prosecutor joins in a petition and indicates the complaint would have not been filed or would have been dismissed had that newly discovered evidence been available at the time of the original charges.
Sir Newman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Senator Latz. And insofar as these changes are concerned, the County Attorneys Association is in support. Is that correct?
That's what I am informed, Senator Newman, as well. I should note, Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, There are some technical changes in sections 3 to 6. Most significant change there of substance is the one I described relating to the damage limit of $100,000 per year in custody and $50,000 per year of supervised release, or if not on supervised release, as a registered sex offender. And then Section 6 adds two subdivisions relating to survival of a claim. So if a person is exonerated but they die before the claim for compensation is completed, that claim can be picked up by the personal representative of the estate. The fact that they've deceased may be accounted for in the amount of compensation ultimately determined, but it recognizes that there's an impact on their family, of them having been absent from their family for the number of years they're in prison. Subdivision 8 is also new. It provides for recapturing unpaid child support payments from any compensation that is made. Section 7 of the original bill was deleted. It was a provision that required the Department of Corrections to provide transitional services after a person is released. It turns out the Department of Corrections provides almost no transitional services to anyone now once they're released, but for $100 walk-away money, unless they've earned $500 while they've been in prison, and a cab ride to a halfway house if that's where they're going. So asking them, we thought there was more, and that would be a subject for a different discussion someday, but we didn't want them to have to create a whole new section of transitional services for the rare occasions when this happens, when they're not already providing that services to those who have been convicted and are then released at the completion of their service, or of their sentence, rather. That's pretty much the changes.
Thank you, Senator Latz.
Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, I looked at the original bill, and then I looked at the amendment that was a delete everything, and I, too, had the same concerns that Senator Newman had. The original bill had 6 pages of almost single-spaced lines on it, and now it's down to 3. And so that was my question. I'm glad Senator Newman raised the question of asking what is the real differences between the original bill. Being a co-author on your bill, I was concerned that there was negotiations going on outside of the committee process, and I certainly wasn't part of that negotiation, so I'm glad that Senator Newman raised those questions.
And I apologize. I should have gone through that level of detail in my initial presentation of the bill.
And one question I did have, though, is on lines 9 and 10 of page 1. This is on the definition of exoneration, and I know that it's similar to the language found in the original bill, but on line 9 toward the end of it, it says, or the petitioner was not found guilty at the new trial. That's specifically for the purposes of exoneration type of a hearing, as opposed to an appellate case where a person would bring their case to an appeal trial.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, that's correct. This would be if there were a new trial that were ordered, and they had the new trial, and the person was acquitted or found not guilty.
Right.
It does not bring into the case those categories of technical or appellate level reversals of judgment, which we wanted to get away from. We don't want to get into judging was one legal interpretation, another legal interpretation, ultimately the right one. This was just, did they have the trial? If it was a new trial, were they acquitted?
Sure. All right. That's
Thank
all
you, Senator Limmer. We have the A11. Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, just a question to Senator Latz and what he was covering. You said there's a two-year statute of limitations to have your record expunged. I'm wondering if I followed that right, and if you didn't do that within the 2 years, you'd lose your chance to? And why wouldn't we just, in an exoneration, why wouldn't we just make it automatic that the record should be expunged?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrum, The two-year statute of limitations does not apply to the expungement proceeding. That's the two-year statute of limitations applies to commencing an action under this new statute to seek exoneration and compensation. The only expungement-related change is in Section 2 of the bill, where we add to the definition of resolutions in favor of the defendant an exoneration pursuant to this new statute.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, if they become exonerated and then pursue compensation, that would have to be done within 2 years.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, yes, unless for some reason they did not receive notice required under the new statute, and then they'd have 3 years from the date of notice.
Very good. Thank you.
I'm sorry, from the date of the order was issued, but they get an extra year.
Okay.
Senator Latz renews the A11 amendment. Further discussion? Not all in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. And Senator Latz, you have an A12, I believe, which has appropriation reduction, or that would be the impact that's being distributed. And if you'd like to comment on that or yield to Mr. Nauman, whatever Thank your you. Pleasure.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the A11 amendment changed one thing. It did change also, and it was more of a technical way of addressing things as to the process by which compensation, if granted, would ultimately be transmitted. We changed the process a little bit, so the final decision totally rests in the hands of the legislature, and the MMB would not have to book any potential claims in terms of fiscal reserves or anything like that. So that aspect of the fiscal impact was taken out by the A11 amendment. The A12 amendment does leave a little bit of expense on the books for MMB in anticipation of a couple of claims that they think will happen within the next fiscal year. So the A12 amendment does appropriate $3,000 to cover the cost of the special panel appointed by the Supreme Court, and that's what the A12.
Questions on the A12? Not. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Senator Latz, I'm going to ask, is there anyone in the audience that has concerns at this point? We understand most of the issues have been resolved. Senator Latz moves that Senate File 2480 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. Further discussion? Not all in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. Thank you, Senator Latz. And Senator Latz, we have House File 3017. You have the Senate File 2620 companion, Public Safety Outdated Redundant Statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is the Public Safety Unsession Bill. Like all the unsession bills before you, it contains outdated, superfluous, redundant language that's being cleaned up. All of the controversial provisions have been removed, if there were any. We've got basically a cleanup bill here. I do have an A2 amendment, which is a technical adjustment to some of the language. I ask that the A2 amendment be adopted.
Okay. Senator Latz, would you like the Senate language adopted?
There's a division report.
In the division report. So let's do the division report. Senator Latz moves the division report. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. And for substitution.
I move the A2 amendment.
The
and
first.
Members, we're substituting the 2620 now. And we have the A2 amendment. Has that been distributed? It's in the packet. Questions on the A2? Not all in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Carried. Senator Latz.
I have nothing further. I'm prepared to move Senate File 2620.
Senator Latz moves the unsession bill.
Just a moment. Chair. So they've done the A2 amendment. We need to put the contents of the Senate file on the House. You should move the contents of the Senate file. It's file 3017. Make a motion for that.
Okay.
Senator Latz, I believe the recommendation from council is that we would move the contents of Senate File 2620 to House File 3017 and that that be recommended to pass as amended.
So moved.
Further discussion? Not? All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you, Senator Latz.
Thank you.
Senator Cohen? Or Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You have
and
Senate
members.
File 2050.
In the interest of time, I'm going to forego my opening comments because we do have sessions starting, although they are going to hold the beginning of session until we complete our work here. In your packets, there is the list of bills that are included in this package, and I'm just going to mention them briefly and tell you where the fiscal impacts are. Enclosed is provisions to allow mothers to stay in the workforce by expanding family leave and providing reasonable accommodations for pregnant nursing employees, and that includes Senate File 1956 by Senator Sieben, and we do have an amendment, kind of a clarifying amendment in that section. That also
Senator Pappas, would you like that distributed?
No, not yet.
Oh, okay.
Not until I go through this whole thing. Then we also have Senate File 2000, the Senator Sharon bill, which provides workplace protections for nursing mothers. Also enclosed is Senate File 2274, Senator Franson's bill to support women in non-traditional occupations and apprenticeships, and there is a $750,000 appropriation in this area. Senate File 2158, Senator Jensen's bill to support women-owned businesses in non-traditional industries. And there's a $500,000 grant proposal one time in connected with this proposal. Reducing the gender pay gap through enforcement of equal pay laws, that's my bill, Senate File 1806. I do have, as part of my cleanup amendment, I do have an amendment for that, which we'll pass out shortly. And that does include having the Department of Human Rights determine that state businesses that contract with the state who have 40 employees or more and with contracts over $500,000 comply with state equal pay laws and federal equal pay laws and also requires a report. And that will be $674 in the first year and then $426,000 a year thereafter for the compliance activities. We have included Senate File 1999 by Senator Goodwin. That allows employees to discuss their compensation without fear of adverse consequences. And that one, we are still under discussion where to place that in the statute, so that's kind of an ongoing discussion. To address the economic consequences of domestic violence, stalking, and sexual assault, we have Senate File 2111, Senator Eakin, to expand unemployment insurance eligibility to include victims of stalking and sexual assault. And 2006 by Senator Wicklund to allow employees to use existing sick time to deal with the significant consequences as a result to the impacts as a result of violence. And then we also have enhancing retirement security by considering a state retirement savings plan or other options for those low-income employees without a employer-provided option. And the cost of that study is $750,000. That's one-time money. And then we wrap up by extending our ability to use sick pay to grandparents to care for an ill or injured grandchild. This is part of the Women's Economic Security Package, and my opening comments you'll hear on the floor. Mr. Chairman, then.
Senator Pappas, before you continue, Senator Tomasoni moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'd like the A-12 amendment to be passed out. And Mr. Bonner then has some oral amendments to that amendment.
Okay, if we could have that distributed.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we've had it distributed. Mr. Bodern?
Mr. Chairman, before Mr. Bodern speaks, I did want to just clarify that this amendment, which kind of cleans up the equal pay certificate section, is largely the result of an hour and a half of sitting down with Mr. Fuller and Mr. Bodern to basically clean up language that was written in the other body. So we think we have this in good shape, but there was some changes made from the division report, and so we're looking to put that language back to where the division report was and then also add some further clarifying language. And then we're adding a change in Senator Stevens' bill and a change, I think two changes in Senator Stevens' bill. Mr. Bodern. Okay,
Mr. Bodern.
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, the suggested changes that Senator Pappas can incorporate in the A-12 amendment are on page 3, line 1 of the amendment, delete, determine, and insert have authority to audit. And after section on that same line, insert to determine exempt status or, so that the new sentence reads, the commissioner shall have authority to audit compliance with this section to determine exempt status or with respect to employees expected to perform work, et cetera. And then the other oral change to the A-12 amendment would be on page 3, after line 18 of the amendment, insert the instruction, page 13, line 10, delete natural, and insert, open quote, biological, close quote.
Mr. Chairman, biological is more the term of art than natural. So that's why we're making that change. And on line 319 to 326, maybe Senator Sieben would like to address that change.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, this was language that was worked out with some of the business community that was concerned with the accommodation section of my legislation related to pregnancy accommodations.
Okay. This isn't going to work. All right, so we've got the requested A-12 amendment. Is there further discussion on the amendment? If not, Senator Pappas moves adoption of the A-12 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed.
And, Mr. Chairman, I have the A-13 amendment and the spreadsheet that goes with it. And this is to correct some of the appropriation sections in the division report.
Yeah, if we can have that distributed.
Chairman, maybe we could have Mr. Nauman explain the A-13.
Okay, Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chair, members, when the fiscal note came in, we had been originally carrying some dollars that were set aside out of Senator Tomasoni's recommendations, and then this bill was traveling separately. And the fiscal note increased some of the prices of some of those items, so this fiscal note complies with that. In addition, so that's lines 1.3, 1.4, some set-aside language allowing some freedom of use for the commissioner to use up to 5% of the appropriation to administer the grant program. That also conforms with the fiscal note to ensure that the $500,000 grant administrative costs come out from out of that grant. Probably notable, although not significant dollars, is a $24,000 appropriation for enforcement and compliance activities at the Department of Labor and Industry that carries a $24,000 cost ongoing beginning in fiscal. Mr. Chair, this largely, Mr. Mueller prepared a spreadsheet so that members can see how all the dollars play out. There are general fund dollars of 1.948. The division originally marked up 1.837. So you can see the difference would be between about $100,000. And there's some workforce development appropriations as well as the miscellaneous special revenue fund for a total of 2.735.
Ask for a couple comments in a minute, but first we have the A13 amendment.
I'll move that.
Senator Pappas moves adoption of the A13 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, that's it. If the Finance Committee is okay with the spreadsheet and everything, we're ready to go. I would move that Senate Fall 2050 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor.
Okay, Senator Pappas, a couple of questions. Maybe more of a comment. Obviously, there's a significant cost to this bill. I want members to understand that we track this in the budget bill, so it certainly balances. But it still is a fairly significant expenditure, obviously, for some important reasons. So maybe, Senator Pappas, just a couple of comments. Obviously, there's some additional FTEs that are necessitated to maintain some of the new programming and some of what's required. What in particular is being utilized by management and budget?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
For MMB. There's a cost to MMB, and so I'm wondering about, I'm trying to glance through the bill as to involvement of that agency.
Fairly recently we got the fiscal note from MMB regarding the minor provisions we have in the paid sick pay section.
Okay.
So by extending sick pay to people who are victims of domestic violence, for example, there could be impact on an agency, but it varies a lot. It could be that they need overtime to cover for that person, or if there's an extended leave of a grandparent taking care of a grandchild. So, you know, MMB, they're trying to figure out. It might have no impact on some agencies, and some agencies it might have more of an impact. We're not able to cover that part of the fiscal note, but we certainly will be in discussions with them. I talked to someone from MMB last night as this goes toward conference committee on how we might mitigate some of those costs or provide perhaps some of the undue hardship language that Senator Seidman has adopted in her section of the bill that would also apply here.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair, I'll also highlight that I know that looks like a large number, and I'm not discounting it, but to suggest that we have covered a portion of it already. Members will see that on Mr. Mueller's spreadsheet. Under management and budget, the Secure Choice Retirement Plan report of $750,000, so that top-line number that you're citing from the fiscal note is covered by $750,000. It's the ongoing piece and the delta between the 1.1 and the 750 that remains uncovered. Not insignificant by any means, but I think it's Senator Pappas' intention to continue working through some of that.
Right. Okay. And some of the tails dollars could be worked out in future contract negotiations. It's probably more a concern of the first year.
Okay. And Senator Pappas, let me ask, I'm conversant with almost all of the bill and the issues raised. But relative to some of the grants for non-traditional employment in industries, what's the definition of that?
We might ask Senator Tomassoni that question because these bills came through his division, or I'm not sure if Senator Franson or Senator Jensen are here. I'm not as – or Ms. Fitzpatrick. She knows.
All right, let's try that as opposed to Senator Tomassoni. Don't stare at me. I didn't ask you.
Let's hear it.
I need to have the question repeated. I might know the answer. You never know.
Definition of non-traditional, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Where are you going?
Do you want to know how much is buried in my bill? Is that what you want to know?
No. No, this is more of the policy end of it.
Mr. Chairman, this is Professor Fitzpatrick.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deb Fitzpatrick. I direct the Center on Women and Public Policy at the Humphrey School. I know we've been working with the Department of Employment and Economic Development to tighten up that definition. Non-traditional is usually less than 25% of the employees in that category are women. We've worked with high wage is a category that the department has a high demand and high wage is a definition that the department uses in other programs that they have, and I think Kim may be able to clarify that piece.
Is Ms. Babin going to testify before the committee? Oh, this will be great. Welcome to the committee. I'm sorry, for new members, you should understand. Ms. Babin is the former committee administrator for this committee. As of 4 years ago, you left. But so nice to have you back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's very good to be back. Always happy to be in front of this committee. So I'm Kim Babine, Director of Government Affairs at DEED, and we look to our Labor Market Information Office to help provide some labor market standard definitions that we could provide to this. So, yes, the occupations in high demand, those occupations with a projected 10-year growth rate at least 10% above the average employment growth rate for all occupations. And then the definition of occupations paying a high wage is exactly as the professor mentioned, those occupations paying at least 25% more than the median salary in Minnesota.
So is it possible just to get some examples? So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the point of this is that around 40% of the current pay gap that there's been a lot of discussion about this week is attributed to women and men doing different kinds of work, and the fact that segregation in the workforce has really stalled out, desegregation of the workforce since the mid-90s, and so this program is an attempt to try to help through a variety of possible ways to get more women into non-traditional, high-wage, high-demand occupations.
So hypothetically, something like airplane pilots. Obviously, traditionally, you assume those historically have only been men, quite often military veterans. And it kind of dovetails with the legislation of Senator Johnson's allowing for license plates identifying women veterans. So is something like that considered, and maybe that's because of the specialized training required to be a pilot, maybe that it's a bad example, but would that be considered a non-traditional kind of occupation where historically you now have more women who are pilots, but historically you never thought of women as pilots? Am I on the right track in that regard? Or
yes, Mr. Chair, you are. I don't know whether as that's changing, it moves from beyond 25%. I haven't looked at pilots per se, but yes, that is exactly what we're trying to address, is sort of the continuing role of tradition and stereotypes and different ways that we can go about either through our educational systems, through working with employers. So the grant program that's included in this bill has a variety of possible approaches that could be taken to address the segregation problem.
I think I've seen statistics and articles that at least relative to professional careers, law, medicine, business, if we're looking at MBA programs, that I think upwards of, I don't know if the number is now around 50% or thereabouts of classes for the last several years have been women. So it would, again, in terms of the definition of non-traditional, if you go back X number of years ago, law would obviously be non-traditional. But in contemporary times, I don't know that would be considered non-traditional. So would non-traditional be, again, a position in a manufacturing plant?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I mean, we do have a kind of a focus in this on things like skilled trades, and there's some prioritization for low-income individuals. And in the bill as well, there's a $250,000 appropriation to the Department of Labor and Industry to work on getting more women into their skilled apprenticeship programs. So absolutely, we're looking at those kinds of situations where, in our technical training programs in the state of Minnesota, we see only 3% of the plumbers, the construction trainer, people getting trained in construction, et cetera, being women. And so we think that there's a variety of opportunities for women within those kinds of fields. It doesn't mean that there aren't still some professional fields where women are still a minority, but really I think a big thrust of this bill was looking at those kind of more skilled trades kinds of situations.
So if these efforts work out, hopefully there'll be more women who have access to these kinds of what are termed non-traditional fields then.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is right, and hopefully there will be fewer and fewer categories that are considered non-traditional for women.
Mr. That's helpful.
Since Senator session Pappas. Is supposed to begin now, I'd like to renew my motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I guess before we deal with the bill itself, I'd just be curious. You said that some of this was tracked in the budget bill we passed the other day, and I believe that that day, Tuesday, you mentioned the bottom line on the. You mentioned a little bit about the bottom line on the Senate floor, and so I'm just curious if you could fill, just give us an idea, and maybe Mr. Nauman could help us as to how much is being tracked, how much of this bill was being tracked in that budget bill, and how much we're looking at now, that's not being tracked, and then what our bottom line is right now.
Certainly.
They have a running total of what's going on.
And I will tell you, Senator Fischbach, that this bill was a bit of a moving target in terms of some ongoing changes, and some of that's been reflected in Senator Pappas's amendment and comments. But, Mr. Nauman, if you want to provide a more exacting response.
Yes, so, Mr. Chair and members, relative to the general fund, we are tracking the 674 that you see on Mr. Mueller's spreadsheet. We're also tracking the 750 for the Secure Choice Retirement. The 500,000 in general fund for women entrepreneurs grants. Mm-hmm.
And
the additional compliance and enforcement. Those are the general fund pieces that are covered under the overall tracking. I'll quickly add that the other items that are non-general fund are also, that Mr. Mueller has on his tracking, are also assumed in the tracking, so all 2.735 is covered. The primary point is that if you look at the fiscal note that has been handed out, the line item, specifically Minnesota Management and Budget, if you subtract 750 from that 1.1, Senator Fischbach, I'm just looking at you to see if you're tracking with me.
Mr. Nauman, when you mentioned fiscal note, this is the one.
Yes, Ms. Senator Fischbach, indeed. So the 1.102, if you take 750 off of that, there's roughly 400,000 in expenditures there. And there's a lot of numbers on this page, but we've dissected it into a more simple version of Mr. Mueller's spreadsheet, with the exception of that particular line that is not covered in this tracking. So the additional expenses, as Senator Pappas talked about, of individuals that might be taking more time off as a result of the bill, extended leave, and that work within individual state agencies in the form of overtime or extra employees may be a cost incurred or a new cost schedule for those agencies as a result of this bill. Those pieces are not currently covered in our tracking. And this is a new item that appeared in the fiscal note for us last night.
And so, Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, what I'm understanding is we are not the cost to departments. If departments see an increased cost, we're not tracking that. We're only tracking I'm just making sure that I'm understanding what you mentioned.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, I think I would call that sort of a partial answer. For example, the DALI expenses associated with the enhanced enforcement, the additional $24,000, that's certainly a department expense that we are tracking, the cost of doing the report. What I'm not trying to be obtuse relative to your question, except to parse it a little bit to say and isolate it to the piece that we're not covering is that the cost of the increased leave that would accrue to that would create additional costs for agencies as a result of increased leave.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, I what is not actually contained in the bill, like you said, a study, something that we are directing a department to do, but the employee cost is what I'll call of those additional leaves is what
Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, I think that's a fair way to qualify it.
And then Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, maybe just generally, I guess, broader the whole issue of what's the bottom line, where are we at? Because we always like to know how much more spending is going to happen by the end of session.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, at this stage in the process, of course, there are known knowns and there are unknown knowns, I think is the famous quote. There is a tax bill under consideration today mm-hmm. that will create some additional costs, and if that tax bill is adopted across the Senate floor, as has been recommended to the Senate floor, the total tracking at this point, and the number that I'm using for the purposes of this conversation, is the final budgetary balance at the end of fiscal year 17. That's the constraint that that Senator Cohen has mentioned in a number of occasions. We are at 754.2. The other unknown is the cash in the bonding bill. So that could we've made an assumption about how much cash would be allocated into the bonding bill process that sort of corresponds with Senator Dibble's bill that you'll recall was split apart into two pieces, and part of it was conveyed to the capital investment bill. So that assumes that number is carried over in the capital investment bill. So again, this is a rather long way of saying that the budgetary balance at this point is $754.2 million. With all the items that there's a little bit of savings from Senator Dibble's bill earlier, the $2,000 that's not included in that number. So you can save $2,000 off that number that I just gave you.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear, the cash that could potentially be used for the bonding bill, at least what's been being discussed, that number is included in that bottom line number of $754 million.
Mr. Chair and Senator Miller, at this point, I'm assuming $265.3 million in cash in the bonding bill. That number could grow a little bit relative to the bottom line because of the 754 and the essentially the target was 750 in budgetary balance at the end of the fiscal 17 biennium.
Okay. So, and Mr. Chair, so we're still looking for that $17 million per year entails for Minsky.
We're still
that 754, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, of course, that's a $34 million figure.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pavis, just for clarification, if I could bring your attention to page 11 of your bill.
Of this the division is on the, report?
This is Article 3, Employment Protections. This is the discussion of wage disclosure protection. And I remember in Judiciary we reviewed your bill. Discussion, I think, that's been going on outside of committee process is the new language is put under the auspices of Section 181, kind of an Equal Pay Act. I'm a little confused why it wouldn't be referenced more in labor law section, and I don't know if this has been completely ferreted out or not, but could you tell me if this is the best place for the best remedy? I'm thinking labor law might be a better place.
Right, Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, I did mention this in my brief opening comments that we're actually still trying to figure out where the best place is for this. It started out in human rights, and the thing about human rights is it's a complaint process. Right. If you're under labor law, then it's a litigious process. And so this, and also under labor law, the remedies are not very substantial. So, I mean, we're still trying to figure this out. I had a conversation with Senator Latz about what changes we might be able to make. should we have an informational meeting in Judiciary and discuss this some more since it got changed? And when it was in the Judiciary Committee, it was still in Human Rights. So it got changed in the Jobs Committee. So, and then it got changed again when it went to Senator Tomasoni's division. So we've, you know, we've been in three different sections of law. Maybe there's a fourth section that's going to work for us.
So we're still working on it.
We're still working on that. Absolutely.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, and I have another question for Mr. Nauman because I think we missed it. I was originally, when I asked the question, I asked about how much of this bill was tracked in the budget bill. And I know we got into a lot of other things, and so I just wanted to, as I was looking at my little notes, I wanted to ask that again.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fischbach, you did ask that, and I apologize for skipping over that. So this bill is tracked by itself. There is nothing in the budget bill, per se, that
okay,
is
I'm
tracked.
Sorry.
So what I was trying to identify, I glanced over that quickly, was to just suggest that there have been occasions this session where, for example, the disaster bill that we will hear, natural disaster bill, we'll hear at another point. We booked the money in the budget bill, but the policy will be considered separately. This is an occasion where the reverse is done, or essentially the entire package is being considered and appropriated by itself.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I must have misheard.
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, I think so. I glanced over that too quickly.
Yeah, and I think I misspoke, at least relative to it being in the bill. We are tracking it contemporaneously with the bill. Further discussion? If not, Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 2050 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you,
Senator
very
Pappas,
much.
And we'll see everybody in about 10 days.